This study in the New Testament book of Revelation is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. Professor Andy Woods of the College of Biblical Studies in Houston, Texas, will lead us in this study. It is our prayer that this study will deepen your understanding of the Bible and allow you to draw closer in your relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now let's begin our time of study in the last book of the New Testament.
Well, good morning. We are continuing on in our study through the book of Revelation. This morning we find ourselves in Revelation 13. Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10, is really a record, prophetic record, of the instrument that Satan will use during the tribulation period, a man called the Antichrist, who will catapult himself to the world stage through miracles, including a death and a resurrection from the dead. And many people ask, well, I thought only God could raise the dead. Are you telling me that the dragon or Satan can raise the dead? And I think what we have to understand is that the tribulation period is a period of time when all restraint is removed. The Apostle Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 6 tells us that there's a restrainer in the earth today, and one of these days that restraint will be removed. Satan today can't do whatever he wants to do. I don't think he could raise people from the dead today. But you see, the tribulation period is a unique time. The restraint is completely removed, and Satan has his heyday. He comes forward with counterfeit miracles and signs and wonders, catapulting the beast or the Antichrist to the center of global attention through miracles. And I believe even faking, some would say it's a fake, I believe it's an actual real resurrection from the dead. You can imagine how the world would have reacted if John F. Kennedy, who had been shot, suddenly came back from the grave just a few days later, and the worldwide attention that John F. Kennedy would have received had that happened. And the same type of thing will happen in the future through the work of Satan and the coming Antichrist. But as we drop down, moving the slide forward to Revelation 13, verses 11 through 18, we get a picture here of something called the second beast. Second beast is called the false prophet. Unlike the first beast who arises out of the waters or the sea, the false prophet arises out of the land. So the first beast, I think, is a Gentile, because waters refer in the book of Revelation to Gentile powers or peoples. You see a reference to that in Revelation 17, verse 1 and verse 15. But the land typically refers to the land of Israel. So I believe that this second beast will be a Jew. He will perform miracles on behalf of the first beast. And in fact, he will seek to draw attention to the first beast. And he will do a variety of things. He will promote worship of the first beast. In fact, when you look at Revelation 13 and verse 15, he actually sets up in the temple of God an image of the first beast that has the ability, this image or statue of some kind, has the ability to speak and so forth. So it's a time where satanic miracles are really at their height. And this would put us, as we advance the slides, right in the middle of the tribulation period. Because the event which marks the midpoint of the tribulation period, according to Daniel's prophecy of the 70th week, is that the Antichrist will desecrate the temple. Moving the slides forward, he will actually imitate what a man named Antiochus did in the intertestamental period. Antiochus, we know from the Maccabees books that we don't consider inspired, but they contain some good historical information. This man, Antiochus Epiphanes, about 165 BC, set up an image in the temple. It was an image of Zeus. And he is portrayed in Daniel 11:31 and Daniel 9:27 as kind of a forerunner. if you will, of what the future Antichrist will do. So the future Antichrist will have the false prophet set up an image for him in the temple, the rebuilt temple. This would be the third Jewish temple. And this, of course, marks the midpoint of the tribulation period. And this coming second beast does a number of other things. He comes bringing in a one-world system, a cashless society. That's described in Revelation 13, verses 16 through 18. He's the one that seems to be orchestrating it on behalf of the first beast. And it specifically says that no one can buy or sell unless they receive a mark on their right hand or their forehead. The number of the beast himself will be 666, but everybody must receive this mark in order to participate in this global cashless society. And, you know, as we look around our world today, we clearly see politicians in speech after speech talking about globalism or a new world order, you know, bringing in global peace. Some even go so far as to say we want to bring in world government. And it's very interesting to me how the climate is in place for this coming one world system. You know, if there's a problem today, everybody thinks globalism is the solution. And it is interesting how we are moving progressively towards a more cashless society, the type of thing predicted here in the Bible, where you can actually do commerce today with no cash at all. It's all done through electronic banking and credit cards and debit cards and scanners. And we see, in essence, the world moving in the direction that the Bible predicts as this second beast or this false prophet will orchestrate this one world system on behalf of the first beast, where no one can participate in it unless they swear allegiance to the first beast. Many people today are trying to argue that the first beast is not someone in the future, but it's someone in the past named Nero. And they do this by looking at what we call Nero's numbers. And there's something in ancient languages called gematria, where letters had a numerical equivalent. So you could take somebody's name and spell it out in either Greek or Hebrew and attach the right number to the right letter and then add up the total and get a number for everybody. And what is argued is that the name Neron Kaiser, which simply means Nero Caesar in Hebrew, when you attach the right number to the right letter and add up the total, yields the number 666. And so many people say, oh, don't worry about a future Antichrist. This is a prophecy about Nero. And there are many, many problems, I believe, with this view that is being promoted, trying to tell us that the Antichrist has already come. For example, when we advance the slides, we see a lot of problems. One problem is the inconsistent use of numbers. People that promote these types of views don't like to take numbers in the book of Revelation literally. They don't like to take the thousand-year kingdom literally, for example. But suddenly the number 666 to them is very literal. I believe it's literal as well, but I believe all the numbers in the book of Revelation are literal. And you'll notice that this calculation only works in Hebrew. It doesn't work in Greek. And this is a problem because the book of Revelation was written to a Greek-speaking audience. And furthermore, none of the church, early church fathers ever believed that this calculation had anything to do with Nero. And furthermore, they're doing a little bit of cherry picking because they have to throw in the title rather than just the name to make the whole thing work. And beyond that, as we saw in our earlier episodes, the book of Revelation was written in AD 95, a good couple of decades after Nero left the face of the earth through death. And so I don't think that this beast is Nero or any other person of the past, but it is none other than the future Antichrist. As we advance the slides, we see Nero did not usher in persecution for exactly 42 months, the way it's described here. He never controlled the entire planet. He never forced people to receive a mark on their right hand or their forehead to participate in the global economy. Advancing the slide again, we see he never coerced the world to worship a singular image of him set up in the temple. He never resurrected from the dead. He never had a miracle-working false prophet as sort of a sidekick. And he never received global veneration. So as much as people want to make this something of the past, this is actually a future figure that is yet to come. These are the two human beings that Satan is using in the end times to persecute the nation of Israel and bring about global deception. You'll notice in Revelation 13 and verse 18, it says the number of a man. So this is an actual human being. Paul referred to him in 2 Thessalonians 2 in verse 3 as the lawless one. He is beastly in the sense that he will be ferocious in character, but that does not negate from the fact that we're dealing with an actual person or an actual human being. Both the false prophet and the future Antichrist will be future human beings. And as we advance the slides, we come now to chapter 14. Chapter 14 is what I like to call six scenes of hope, because at this point things look very bleak. Satan is persecuting the nation of Israel. The Antichrist and the false prophet are also persecuting Israel and running, you know, the entire planet. And you kind of get the impression that God has lost control of things when you study chapter 12 and chapter 13. But chapter 14 is sort of a counterbalancing chapter, because essentially what it gives us are six scenes of hope. And you'll notice the expression, another angel. Every time you see the expression, another angel, the scenery is shifting. So you'll notice that the first scene of hope is in Revelation 14, verses 1 through 5. It's the preservation of the 144,000 Jewish evangelists who will die, but their souls will be preserved by God. They will no doubt be persecuted by the beast, but their souls will be preserved by God. And then the next scene, the second scene, is in Revelation 14, verses 6 and 7, and that's the proclamation of the eternal gospel through an angel. Now, normally the best preachers of the gospel are those who have been redeemed by the gospel. But here God is setting aside his normal way of doing things, and he's allowing an angel to preach the eternal gospel just to make sure that that gospel blankets the world during this terrible time period that we call the tribulation period. And then the next scene of hope is in Revelation 14 and verse 8. We have the prediction of Babylon's destruction. And we'll have much more to say about that when we get to chapter 17 and 18. And as we move to the next slide, we see in Revelation 14, verses 9 through 12, the ultimate destruction and doom of the beast worshippers. So all who receive this mark on their right hand or their forehead during this time period, and in the process swear allegiance to the beast by participating in his one world system, will damn themselves to hell. And in fact, that damnation is described in very graphic terms in Revelation 14, verses 9 through 12. And in fact, if you look at Revelation 14 and verse 11, you see a very clear reference there to the eternal reality of hell. Revelation 14, verse 11 says, "The smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast and his image, and who receive the mark of his name." Now, when you begin to talk like this, people get very scared and they say, "Well, wait a minute, you know, I work at a certain company and they gave me a number with a little card to get in and out of the building." And you know, I oftentimes get emails from people saying, "Have I gone too far and, you know, sworn allegiance to the beast?" And the answer is you have not. This is only something that can happen in the tribulation period itself. So the people that are doing this know full well what they're doing, and they're swearing allegiance to the beast, and they are rejecting Jesus Christ in the process. And the moment they move in that direction is the moment they consign themselves to an eternity separated from God. So the beast system perhaps looks glamorous to the unsaved at this time, but we're told in this scene of hope that the whole thing will end in destruction with the ultimate doom of the beast worshippers. And then the next scene of hope is the ultimate victory of the tribulation martyrs. We find that in Revelation 14 and verse 13. There will be many martyrdoms during this time period, but if they're killed for the cause of Christ and if they're believers in the Lord Jesus Christ, their souls will go immediately into the presence of God. And finally, the sixth and final last scene of hope is in Revelation 14, verses 14 through 20. And this is a description of the Christ-rejecting nations at Armageddon. This is a description of what happens to those who align themselves with the Antichrist. And it's a barbaric scene, in a sense, because it begins to talk about blood rising as high as the horses' bridles for 200 miles. And with these six scenes of hope, we come to the conclusion of this very long, non-chronological, parenthetical insertion that takes place after the trumpet judgments. And now the only judgments left to come upon the earth are the bowl judgments. And as we advance the slides, we begin to see that where we are, we're in the second half of the tribulation period. The bowl judgments are about to be unleashed. Advancing the slides, once again, we have in chapter 15 a prelude of these coming bowl judgments. So what you have described there are the seven last plagues are held by angels, verse 1. Verses 2 through 4, the tribulation martyrs begin to praise God for the justice that's finally coming. You'll recall as early as Revelation 6, these martyrs are crying out to God for vengeance, and he says, wait just a little while longer. And now these very same martyrs are praising God because justice is finally coming to the earth. And when you go down to Revelation 15, verses 5 through 8, essentially what you have are angels emerging from the heavenly tabernacle, holding these seven bowls. And every time an angel is going to pour out a bowl upon the earth, another judgment comes to the earth. So this is the final set of seven that is coming. Just as there were judgments with the seals and judgments with the trumpets, now we have judgments with the bowls taking place. So Revelation 15, by and large, is a prelude to those bowl judgments. It's a heavenly scene. And now we move into Revelation 16, where we actually see these judgments manifesting. The first bowl is poured out. Before that first bowl is poured out, in fact, back in verse 1, there's a command. The command is to these angels to come forward with their bowls. The first bowl is poured out in verse 2, and boils appear all over the bodies of the Christ-rejecting people in the tribulation period. The second bowl is poured out, and now the ocean becomes blood red. Now, you might recall back in Revelation 8, about verse 8, with the trumpet judgments, a third of the earth's ocean became blood red, or turned to blood, as it appeared to John. Now all of the earth's ocean becomes blood red. So you see what's happening is God is progressively turning up the intensity of these judgments, and they're getting harsher and harsher and harsher. And as this happens, the human heart is actually becoming harder and harder and harder against God. And then we have the next, advancing the slides, the next bowl judgment. This would be bowl number 3. And now the earth's fresh water supply turns to blood. And then we have bowl number 4, and the sun begins to scorch people. You see that in Revelation 16, verses 8 and 9. And then you have the fifth bowl poured out, and you see the whole world is enveloped in darkness. And God has, in a certain sense, a sense of humor. He basically is saying, do you like darkness? The darkness of the Antichrist? Let me give you physical darkness. And then we go down to Revelation 16 and verse 12, and the Euphrates River is dried up. Now, why is the Euphrates River dried up? To expedite the path for the kings of the east. And as we advance the slides, you'll remember that with Trumpet 6, we had the releasing of an army of 200 million from the east of the Euphrates River, and they're traveling to the Valley of Armageddon there in northern Israel, and in the process they kill, I believe it said, a third of the Earth's population. The east here, I don't think, is a reference to China, but rather is a reference to Babylon. As we advance the slides, you'll remember that every time we see the word east in the Bible, whether it be Eden or Babel or the wise men coming from the east, the referent there is always to Babylon. And so at this point, the Euphrates River is dried up to expedite that army of 200 million. So I believe we have to understand the sixth trumpet and the sixth bowl together. They're working towards the same end. And why is this army of 200 million coming from Babylon or to the east of the Euphrates River? I believe, and we'll see a lot more about this in Revelation 17 and 18, but I believe that will be the capital of the Antichrist during this period of time. And he is orchestrating the armies of the earth from that particular venue. And that's why there's a reference constantly to Babylon in the book of Revelation. And one of the things that's very interesting as we advance the slides is the judgments in the book of Revelation, particularly these bowl judgments, sound so similar to the plagues in the book of Exodus. For example, there were sores in the sixth plague of the book of Exodus and the first bowl judgment in Revelation 16. Rivers to blood was in the first plague in the book of Exodus and the third bowl judgment in Revelation 16. Darkness was in the ninth plague in the book of Exodus and the fifth bowl judgment in Revelation 16. Hail, which we haven't talked about yet, but we'll talk about in just a minute, is there in the seventh plague in the book of Exodus and the seventh bowl judgment in the book of Revelation. And we might ask ourselves, why these similarities? Well, I think these similarities are here to show us that God is taking the world out of bondage. And just as he, in the plagues in the book of Exodus in the days of Egypt, took Israel out of Egyptian bondage, In essence, what is happening in the book of Revelation is the ultimate exodus is occurring, where God is taking the whole planet out of the bondage and the judgment that it has been in ever since Satan began to rule this planet, since the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. So the ultimate exodus is taking place. And just as those judgments in the book of Exodus became progressively more intense to weaken Pharaoh's grip over the nation of Israel, God is turning up the heat with these judgments. You know, a third of the sea becomes blood in chapter 8. Now all of the sea becomes blood in chapter 16. Just like in the book of Exodus, the temperature or the intensity is being turned up, and it's going to have the ultimate result of breaking the will of Satan, just as the plagues in Egypt had the ultimate goal through increased intensity of breaking the will of Pharaoh to release God's people. And just as those judgments in the book of Exodus were very literal judgments, the judgments here in the book of Revelation are very literal as well. And so I believe this is one of the reasons why there's a direct parallel between the judgments of Revelation 16 and the judgments spoken of in the book of Exodus. And as we advance the slides one more time, we are at a six in a series. We're between bowl six and bowl seven, and so we have another non-chronological parenthetical insertion. It's there in Revelation 16. Verses 13 through 16. It's very brief, but it basically is saying, while we're on the subject, it's saying while we're on the subject of the drying up of the Euphrates and the movement of the army of 200 million to Armageddon, what happens is the demons begin to gather all of the nations to this valley called Armageddon. In the Old Testament, it's referred to as Mount Megiddo. It's a valley in northern Israel where the final battle of battles will take place. And it's very interesting. I remember the Persian Gulf War when that happened. how quickly the nations of the world assembled in that part of the world. And now this very thing is happening again. And consequently, Satan, through demonic powers, it would seem, is gathering these nations. We keep seeing references to Satan's miracle-working powers throughout our treatment in the book of Revelation. And Satan is a miracle worker, just like God is. He doesn't have as much power as God, obviously, but he clearly has the ability to perform miracles. And you see these demons performing these signs and wonders to gather these nations to this valley called Armageddon. And now that we're finished with that non-chronological parenthetical insertion, we now move to the seventh bowl judgment. It's described in Revelation 16. Verses 17 through 21, and according to verse 17 of chapter 16, with this, the judgment of God is completed. The judgments have all transpired and taken place. And with this seventh bowl in verses 18 through 21, what we discover are great topographical and cosmological changes. In fact, what's described in verses 18 through 21 is literally the greatest earthquake in the history of the world. And again, this is another example why I am a futurist. I do not locate these events somewhere in the past. Where in history has it ever been described as the greatest earthquake in human history? And yet that is going to happen as that final bowl is poured out. And by the way, if you take a look at verses 18 through 21, what begins to be described is 100-pound hailstones begin to drop in the full view of men. So hailstones of 100 pounds are transpiring. Cosmological changes are transpiring. The greatest earthquake in human history is transpiring. And something else is transpiring. Take a look at verse 19. It says in verse 19 with this seventh bowl, the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. And so essentially what you have described here is the great city is destroyed. Now, going back to Revelation 11 and verse 8, I believe the great city is Jerusalem. But then there's another city that's described at the end of verse 19, and that's the city of Babylon. See, all the way through biblical history, Babylon and Jerusalem have always been at odds with each other. Unbelieving Israel crumbles to the ground at this point, and Babylon the Great is destroyed. And you might be asking yourself, well, what is this business about Babylon? I'd like to know a little bit more about it. And consequently, the Holy Spirit says, I'm glad you asked that question. Let me tell you a little bit about Babylon by giving you our final non-chronological parenthetical insertion. So once we hit the end of the bowl judgments, we have a final non-chronological parenthetical insertion. And that non-chronological parenthetical insertion starts in chapter 17, verse 1, and goes all the way through chapter 19, verse 6, as we now have a description of Babylon past, present, and future. And once that little excursion is over, we'll get back on the path and we'll take a look at the return of Christ and the kingdom. But we'll be having a lot more to say about this coming Babylon during our next session together, as we will take a look at Babylon the Great.